It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in on the latest in national politics with Paul Singer from USA Today.
First, as we get closer to July's Republican National Convention, GOP leaders are having to take stances on presumptive nominee Donald Trump. Party leaders have had mixed reactions to Trump, with clear opposition from some people, like 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney, while others, like former Speaker John Boehner, have been early Trump supporters.
Governor Walker's stance on Donald Trump is subject to debate, and yesterday, after remaining relatively silent on the race for the Republican nomination, Walker said that GOP delegates should, quote, vote the way they see fit. Joining us now to tell us more about the governor's comments on Trump is Scott Bauer. He's a correspondent for the Associated Press based in Wisconsin. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So Governor Walker has said that he would support Trump as the presumptive Republican nominee, but how strong has his support been?
He's been real interesting in how he's come down on Donald Trump. Remember, Walker ran for president. He dropped out in September. When he was running, he signed a pledge that said he would support whoever the presumptive nominee is for the party. After he dropped out, he didn't endorse anyone until a week or so before Wisconsin's primary. He came out for Ted Cruz, campaigned for Cruz. Cruz won Wisconsin, then ended up being the last state that Donald Trump didn't win. So when it became clear that Trump was the presumptive nominee, Walker said, well, I promised I would support the presumptive nominee. That's Trump. So, you know, I'm endorsing him. But in recent weeks, he started to back away from that and said that he wants to see how Trump does between now and the convention. He's got some concerns about him. And then yesterday, when questioned about Speaker Ryan saying that he thought delegates to the convention ought to vote their conscience, Governor Walker said that he agreed. He thought that was a legitimate thing to say and that he felt delegates should vote as they see fit.
And what does that mean exactly, that delegates should vote as they see fit? I mean, how much leeway do those delegates have?
Right. And as we learn more and more about how the convention works, the more convoluted and complicated it is. At the same time that the governor is saying he thinks delegates ought to do that, he, as a delegate from Wisconsin, said that he is going to remain committed and bound by the state Republican Party rules, which say you, as a delegate, have to vote for the candidate who won either the state, if you're an at-large delegate, or the congressional district you're representing. So for Walker, you know, he's an at-large delegate. Ted Cruz won the state. He's casting his ballot for Ted Cruz because the state party rules require that. But I think he was speaking more broadly to delegates maybe in other states where they might have some different rules are operating under, or delegates who are trying to get the rules for the convention itself changed that may free them up to act, to vote their conscience, and allow them to vote for someone other than maybe Donald Trump.
Well, and speaking of that effort to provide that option to vote for someone other than Donald Trump, over the weekend there was a conference call of anti-Trump GOP delegates who are becoming more and more vocal. The movement is asking for a rule change so delegates can vote their conscience, not be bound even in a first vote. How will Governor Walker's comments affect that? Is that going to amplify those calls, or is his just kind of on its own on the side?
Yeah, I think he's another prominent Republican who is, you know, saying things that would give those people in that dump Trump movement, give them hope and give them something to point to and say, here's another voice saying that we ought to have maybe an alternate route. Governor Walker is not as loud of a voice as some of the others who are out there trying to organize delegates. I'd say he's more akin to what Speaker Ryan said, but he is, you know, he's part of the mix of people who are kind of grumbling about Trump and, you know, maybe trying to find some other alternative, and yet there is no other name of a candidate out there. Governor Walker reiterated again yesterday that he's not interested in running for president or being, you know, thrust into that role somehow at the convention. So for as many people who want to get rid of Trump as the presumptive nominee, there hasn't been a name yet that's floated to the top as an alternative.
We're talking right now with Scott Bauer. He's a correspondent based in Wisconsin for the Associated Press. And we're talking about comments by Governor Walker and others that delegates to the GOP convention next month should vote their conscience, or as Governor Walker said, vote the way they see fit. Now, we talked about two prominent Wisconsinites on the national stage, Governor Scott Walker and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. There's also the chair of the Republican National Committee, also from Wisconsin, Reince Priebus. Have we heard any response from him on calls for rule change for delegates?
You know, he's probably commented on it. I haven't seen anything lately. You know, Reince has consistently said that the party will come together. He's been supportive of Donald Trump publicly once he became the presumptive nominee. You know, so he's got a delicate line to walk, because you've got the RNC, the Republican National Committee, is providing a lot of manpower, the money, the infrastructure to help not only Donald Trump but all Republican candidates on the ballot. So in Wisconsin, for example, you have the RNC. You here in the state, people working, being paid for by the RNC, and their job is to get Republicans elected, and that's from Donald Trump down to your local state assembly member Ron Johnson in between, and everyone else. So, you know, the Republicans they want to win, just like the Democrats want to win, but they're also worried about how Donald Trump at the top of the ticket might affect their chances.
So even Republicans who have been in favor of Donald Trump, or at least have been staying rather neutral about Donald Trump, there was a lot of outcry after he questioned whether a judge could be fair in a Trump University trial because of his Mexican-American heritage. Did Governor Walker come out on that issue?
That was actually the issue that caused him, for the first time publicly, to say that he was that he had fresh concerns about Donald Trump. He disavowed that statement from Trump. He said he wanted to see him rescind it. He wanted to see him address that in some way. That's been a couple weeks ago, as you mentioned. And yesterday, Governor Walker brought it up again and said, you know, I still haven't seen anything from Donald Trump addressing my concern over that comment. He hasn't gone as far as to say that he's not endorsing him, but he's also not saying that he is. He's saying he wants to wait and see, you know, how he does between now and the convention, essentially kicking the can a little bit down the road, but at the same time being more vocally critical of him than maybe some others have been.
And often Donald Trump hits back, and hits back hard, when he feels he's being criticized. Has there been any response from the Trump camp about this statement by Governor Walker, or the kind of equivalent statement by Speaker Ryan?
I haven't seen anything from Donald Trump directly to Governor Walker on this comment. As we know, as you remember, during the primary, when Trump came into the state, he was very critical of Governor Walker, which was another kind of added fuel to the fire to the anti-Trump people here in Wisconsin, saying that he just didn't understand the state. He was criticizing a very popular governor within the Republican base, you know, the people who were coming out to vote. And in very Trump-like fashion, shortly after the primary, he was then praising Governor Walker and almost floating his name as a possible VP candidate. So as with many aspects of this presidential campaign, it's really hard to kind of it's hard not to be surprised anymore, because so many things have gone one way, and then a couple hours later, they've gone the complete opposite direction. So I'd say stay tuned on that front.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet.
That was Scott Bauer. He's a correspondent based in Wisconsin for the Associated Press. He talked to us about Governor Walker's latest stance on presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, food insecurity is a big problem throughout Wisconsin. We'll learn about what can be done to alleviate the issue.
Right now, we get the latest in national political news.
And there's a lot going on. The Senate was unable to come to an agreement on gun control measures, so House Democrats are now forcing the issue in their Chamber of Congress.
And Donald Trump's campaign is facing a shakeup following the firing of campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. Joining us now to give us the latest is Paul Singer. He's the Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Paul, we're going to start with the breaking news. Last week we had the Democratic filibuster in the Senate. This week we have a sit-in in the House. Set the stage. What's happening there?
Yeah, you know, I teach journalism, and I teach my students that you can't filibuster in the House, and apparently I'm wrong, because what is happening right now is a bunch of Democrats essentially are filibustering in the House. They have staged a sit-in. They refuse to return to order. The chairman of the proceedings gaveled it closed and said, well, since we can't have order, we're just going to go into recess, and the Democrats have continued to sit there and talk about wanting a gun vote.
How unusual is this?
It's weird. I've never seen anything like it. Now, I will say, in 2008, Republicans did something sort of similar. Democrats tried to recess the House for the summer. Republicans wanted a vote on oil drilling. Democrats said no and voted to recess and close the House, at which point the Republicans refused to leave and continued giving speeches for several days, actually. The Democratic leadership at the time went so far as to turn off the lights and shoo all the reporters out of the chamber. So Republican leadership has not turned off the lights yet. There's no C-SPAN cameras, but C-SPAN is now airing it via some congressman's live Facebook stream. So modernity may be winning out here.
Wait, so C-SPAN, as I understand it, wasn't airing it because it was not officially gaveled into session. Is that right? So why can't they just show up and broadcast anyway? Why do they need some guy's Facebook feed?
Yeah, C-SPAN doesn't actually run the cameras in the chamber. All the cameras in the chamber in the House and the Senate are run by the U.S. Congress and controlled by the leadership, that is the Republican leadership in this case. And they only provide a feed while the Senate and the House are in session. So as soon as it was Congressman Ted Poe who was presiding over the chamber at the time. As soon as he gaveled and said, we are out of session, the stream cuts off. And no reporters are allowed to have video, and no independent cameras are allowed in these chambers. The only TV cameras we have are the House cameras that feed C-SPAN. So C-SPAN had no way to get pictures either. So what they've been doing is just basically using pirate video from lawmakers on the floor who are broadcasting with Facebook or Periscope or other sort of live streaming apps.
Is it just a single congressperson who's broadcasting, or is there more than one?
Well, it was Congressman Beto O'Rourke from Texas had been doing it the most on Facebook Live recently, but there's been a couple other members who have been Periscoping it. I think Periscope actually put up a channel where you can see all the feeds that are coming in. It's kind of wacky.
Well, Congressman John Lewis from Georgia has been leading this, as I understand it. He's a civil rights icon, and he had this to say earlier today.
Deadly mass shootings are becoming more and more frequent. Mr. Speaker, this is a fight. It is not an opinion. We must remove the blinders. The time for silence and patience is long gone. We are calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor. Give us a vote. Let us vote. We came here to do our job. We came here to work. The American people demand an action.
And Paul, in your years covering Congress, hearing that quote there from Congressman John Lewis, what do you think about how this could resolve and what it means?
Well, you know, there are few people in Congress that have the kind of credibility of a John Lewis to speak on this kind of, civil disobedience, basically. I mean, this is where he came from. He came out of the civil disobedience, the civil rights movement. And you know, Lewis's argument, and the argument of Democrats in general here, is not that Congress has to pass a gun control bill, but they want to get a vote. They believe they have the right to have a vote. Now, in the Senate a week or so ago, Democrat Chris Murphy did the same thing. He took to the floor for 15 hours and basically said, I'm not going to give up the floor until I have a promise that we'll get a vote. And sure enough, last week, this week, I've lost track of my days, I guess it was earlier this week, the Senate did vote on four gun control measures. All four were defeated, so there you go. And now there's some talk of a possible compromise measure. I presume the House Republicans will offer up some sort of a a gun control measure. In fact, there's already a couple they've proposed. Again, ones that Democrats won't be able to swallow, but at least they'll get a chance to vote on them. So maybe they'll do that. But again, keep in mind, part of the problem here is that the House is supposed to go into recess on Friday for the week and not come back until after the 4th of July, and Democrats want to vote before then. We'll see if that's possible.
Well, you said these would not be votes that would be passed in the House, even should they get a floor vote. But what would those votes mean politically and maybe symbolically?
Well, Congress is basically all about symbolic votes now. That's all they're for. And to give you the example, in the Senate, there was, you know, the issue, of course, as I'm sure your listeners are familiar, you know, what should we do? Should we expand background checks? Well, the Democrats proposed an amendment to expand background checks to additional types of gun sales. The Republicans offered alternative language that would provide more money for the background check system, but then create some limits on background checks that aggravated the Democrats. So the Republicans could vote against the Democratic bill, the Democrats could vote against the Republican bill, and then they could both issue press releases saying it was the other guys that voted against doing something on background checks. So that's the symbolism. I mean, what you end up having is votes that are being cast simply to make a political point, not to actually address any point of actual government policy.
But they do create political pressure, don't they? This kind of action?
Well, presumably. I mean, I guess the reason that there were votes in the Senate this week was because of the pressure that was begun by Mr. Murphy's filibuster. It, presumably also, this event going on today in the House raises the pressure on House Republican leadership to offer some sort of a vote on some sort of a gun bill. But I can virtually guarantee you it's not going to be a gun bill the Democrats are going to want to vote for.
We're talking to Paul Singer right now, Washington correspondent for USA Today. We're going to move on and look at the Trump campaign. A presumptive GOP nominee, Donald Trump, made news this week, and he fired his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. How do you read that move? What does it signal?
Well, if nothing else, it signals a transition in the Trump campaign. This is a campaign that has been largely the brainchild of Donald Trump. I mean, it just sort of runs with his stream of consciousness. And Mr. Lewandowski was sort of the perfect channel for that. Now there has been a bit of a power struggle inside the campaign, clearly, and it looks like the winners of that struggle were Mr. Trump's family and sort of a more professional class of a political consultant represented by Paul Manafort. I mean, I think what you'll see is this: a campaign can't be one guy and a couple of dudes in the back room thinking, I think I'll tweet something. You know, they have to have a broader strategy, a bigger staff, more people on the ground, more targeting of their advertising, et cetera. And I think that's what this is a transition to, is a more, forgive the wording, a more professional campaign.
And is that something that you see Donald Trump, the candidate, embracing? I gather Lewandowski's theory had sort of been let Trump be Trump.
Yeah.
And you expect to see a transformed candidate along with building that infrastructure you're talking about, communications and a ground game and all of that stuff.
It's hard to tell. I mean, he gave a speech today that was a very forceful attack on Hillary Clinton, but it was delivered in a much different way. It was a much lower volume. It was not at a giant rally. It was a much smaller crowd. It was handled with a teleprompter, with a prepared speech, prepared remarks. So there you have what looks like a more polished candidate delivering a very strong sort of bare-knuckle message without yelling and flapping his arms around, and maybe that is part of the transition you'll see.
News also broke this week that Donald Trump's campaign budget was not looking so in the black, especially
striking
compared to Hillary Clinton's. As a, you know, one of the, well, we assume a very wealthy person who doesn't especially need to rely on this, what is the signal to have to be kind of in the red, not doing so well with fundraising?
It's kind of stunning. I mean, you wouldn't anticipate that he would be so low on cash on hand. I think we said he had, you know, less than $2 million cash on hand at this point, which is striking. It really is unusual. Now, right, here's where we get to answer the question: does Donald Trump have a lot of liquid assets? Does he have a lot of cash lying around he can infuse into his campaign? We don't know. But this, again, gives the point that Trump has had difficulty getting big donors to sit down and write big checks. That stage of the campaign has to begin now. because Trump is going to need money, whether it's his own or somebody else's. He can't run for president without money, no matter how much free media we give him.
We're going to move on to look at the Democratic side of things. Bernie Sanders acknowledging a bit of doubt on C-SPAN this week. Here he is.
It doesn't appear that I'm going to be the nominee, so I'm not going to be determining the scope of the convention.
Now, he's being asked about whether he would be delivering a speech at the upcoming Democratic convention. What does Bernie Sanders' tone say to you along with those words we just heard?
Well, I think he's understanding that you know, we've moved past the competitive portion of the nomination. He hasn't quit the race. He hasn't announced that he's dropping out, and he hasn't endorsed Hillary Clinton. But he's clearly getting to the point where now the issue is, let's have a conversation about policy. Let's try and shape the platform in ways that we like and try and shape the party rules in ways that we like. But the point of combat now becomes beating Donald Trump, not beating Hillary Clinton. I mean, I think that's pretty clear from where he has been trending, and I think what you heard today is really just the next step in that, of Mr. Sanders sort of burying the hatchet or attempting to start burying the hatchet with Ms. Clinton.
Does he still command the kind of sway that he seemed to a couple of months ago?
Yeah, I think he generates a lot of loyalty amongst his fan base. I think it has been clear all along that a lot of these Democrats were going to endorse Hillary Clinton at some point when Mr. Sanders dropped out. I think there is probably still a rump caucus that is very unhappy and wants more liberal progressive views reflecting the party. There is still a big protest rally expected in Philadelphia, the Democratic Convention, by Sanders supporters who still feel alienated, still feel that they've been sort of locked out of the process and are still mad. I don't think this is over in the sense that the movement that he inspired goes away. The question is, can he effectively channel most of that energy into defeating Donald Trump and therefore electing Hillary Clinton instead of just creating a ruckus for the Democratic Party?
Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Veronica. Be well.
That was Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us there to give us the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, the problem of food insecurity in Wisconsin is a growing concern. We'll learn about what steps can be taken to address the issue. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we talk to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who says the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando emphasizes the need to change blood donation requirements for gay and bisexual men.
First, for many families, the issue of obtaining food and having enough to eat is a chronic concern.
Food insecurity is a growing problem, not only nationwide, but closer to home, right here in Wisconsin. Hunger and food insecurity affects one out of every five children in the state, and 55% of children in Wisconsin public schools qualify for free or reduced lunches.
Joining us now to talk about food insecurity is Nick Heckman. He's the food security policy analyst at Public Health Madison and Dane County. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Well, let's talk about the terminology. What do we mean when we use the term food insecurity?
Well, the technical definition of food insecurity is whether families have enough food for an active and healthy life. And if they don't, then they would qualify as food insecure.
Give us some examples. What are the kinds of things that would happen when a family was experiencing that?
Well, there's a number of different experiences that families could have. They may have to resort to different sources for their food if they don't have direct access to affordable and nutritious food at a grocery store or at another nearby retail site. They may have to go to a convenience store or use fast food for a number of their meals, which can have a whole host of different health consequences down the line as the nutrition is not necessarily as plentiful in those food sources.
And skipping a meal, that kind of thing, is that part of what you might see?
Absolutely. So children and families that are food insecure are measured by the likelihood in which that they would have skipped a meal.
How many people are affected by food insecurity in Dane County and in Wisconsin?
In Dane County, we know we have about 11.6. Excuse me, in the state of Wisconsin, we have about 11.6% of all people are food insecure. The number for Dane County, if we use a slightly different measurement by Feeding America, is about 11.8% of all individuals, and then 17% of all children.
And are there any particular groups of people who are more affected than others?
Absolutely. So disabled people are about 37.7% likely for to have food insecurity. Hispanic and African American households are both around 35%. And single mothers are also near that mark of about 35%.
Now, compared with the national numbers, how does Wisconsin look?
As a whole, Wisconsin ranks slightly below the national average in food insecurity. But if you break it out by those groups, by race and by ethnicity, then some of these groups have striking differences with the national groups. So,
We have higher rates. Is that
yes.
what you're
saying? Yes. Well, so the rate of food insecurity among white households in Wisconsin is lower than the national average, but among African American and Hispanic households, it's significantly higher than national counterparts.
When we look at a problem like food insecurity, what are the factors that contribute to that?
There's a number of different areas that can kind of work together, and we kind of talk about it as four areas, four table legs, as it were, that work together to create a food insecure or food secure environment. And the first one is really the economy. So food insecurity is an income issue at heart, and how much money families have due to their wages and their employment is a big factor, but also other budget items like housing and child care and medical costs that can present immediate challenges. And oftentimes food is the thing that families will crunch out of the budget and be able to flex out of their budget in order to make ends meet.
So income is one factor. What about availability of food?
Yeah, so another table leg would be the availability of affordable and nutritious food. And we see that in the kind of the area of food deserts that get talked about. Is there food available locally for families to actually make those food purchases?
So can it be that sometimes maybe there is income, but there's not a place to purchase the kind of food that would sustain a family?
Yeah, absolutely. There can be specific challenges, and particularly in rural areas, we'll see food insecurity be more directly related to transportation challenges. So if people have a long ways to go to get to the local grocery store or to the nearest grocery store, that may present a lot more difficulty than it would in an urban setting where they may have public transportation or other options.
We're talking with Nick Heckman right now, food security policy analyst for Public Health Madison and Dane County, talking about issues of food insecurity in Wisconsin and also in Dane County. And looking at where Wisconsin is right now at this particular point in time, how does Wisconsin look coming out of the Great Recession?
As a whole, we're still more food insecure than we were prior to the recession. The rate of decline, so things have started to move back towards a lower level of food insecurity, and the economy has been improving in a lot of different ways, but it hasn't been declining as fast as it accelerated back in 2007 and 2008.
Is that true nationally as well, or is that particular to Wisconsin?
Yeah, it is true across the country. We're seeing those same kind of trends of kind of a quick increase that has been followed by a slower decline.
Now, children, I know, are a special concern when you talk about food insecurity. Why the concern so much with children? What happens when children don't have reliable nutrition?
Well, there's many specific lifelong health behaviors that can be established in childhood that are important, particularly around nutrition, but also in the school environment. It's important that kids have access to healthy and affordable and nutritious food options as it sets the stage for learning in the classroom.
And any other health outcomes that might come into play down the road when children aren't getting enough to eat?
We know that actually it's sort of a paradox that food insecurity can be related to obesity and the prevalence of obesity in certain populations because, as I mentioned, when you don't have access to the best food choices, sometimes you make unhealthy food choices that are more affordable in the short term, but end up with ramifications on your health that can lead to obesity, diabetes, and other health issues down the road.
And I suppose sitting in a classroom trying to learn and absorb stuff on an empty stomach, that can't be something that's a positive for grades and learning.
Absolutely not. And another one of our areas of focus is the federal nutrition programs that are very important for addressing food insecurity. So the school meal program, which serves breakfast and lunch to classrooms across the state of Wisconsin, is very important for helping a lot of children and a lot of families during the school year.
And then what happens in the summer? Here we are. There is no school.
Exactly. So there's another federal program, which is called the Summer Food Service Program, which does serve meals to children in summer school and other sites, including some park sites throughout the summer months. In fact, here in Dane County, we've just had our launch of, and across the state, we've had the launch of the summer food program for this year. And it's a very important program, but unfortunately, it's not used at the same rate as the summer, as the school year program. And so as a consequence, we see that a lot of food pantries and emergency food providers see an uptick in people visiting them over the summer months.
And so when school is in swing, do these children, they're getting breakfast and lunch?
It depends on the school, but in a number of schools in Madison and Milwaukee and across the state, we do see that breakfast and lunch are made available to all children. And then in other sites, those meals are, lunch is available universally, but breakfast can be picked up at different districts in different places.
Now, how hard is it to get a handle on food insecurity when you can't really see it? If you just look at someone, you may not know what their life is like at home, whether they're getting enough to eat, especially children, but for grown-ups too. How do you know? So how do you tackle it if you can't see it?
It's a very difficult problem to address while also being sensitive to the personal situation that people are put into. If we need to be sensitive to the stigma that surrounds being food insecure, and for some families that may add to a feeling of not being able to provide. To be sensitive to that while also measuring it effectively, we really need to make sure that our the conversations we have around food insecurity are sensitive and public, and we're normalizing it for families so that they understand that there's paths that they can take to help alleviate their situation in the short term and get back into out of their food crisis.
So you said making it a conversation that's sensitive and that's public. Why does the public aspect help?
Well, I think back to just normalizing the issue and making people feel like they're not alone, that they can access programs like these Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP or Food Share in Wisconsin. These are really critical programs for helping families that are in these situations, that are in a short-term food crisis, kind of make that budget work for the time being, and then bring it all together. And as their situation changes, hopefully through the long-term solution of improving their personal finances through, you know, long-term employment and healthy wages, that their food insecurity situation will be resolved without those supports.
We're talking with Nick Heckman right now. He's the Food Security Policy Analyst at Public Health Madison in Dane County, and he's joining us here in studio to talk about food insecurity in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think could or should be done to alleviate food insecurity? Maybe you've experienced food insecurity yourself. What was your experience? Should the government do more to help people facing hunger, or should it come from somewhere else? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue our conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're continuing the conversation about food insecurity with Nick Heckman, Food Security Policy Analyst at Public Health Madison in Dane County.
And we want to hear from you. What should be done to reduce hunger in our communities? Do you deal with a lack of access to healthy food? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org.
And, Nick, let's talk solutions. We talked about the problem, getting the scope of it, and how many people it can affect here in Wisconsin. What are the solutions?
Well, there's certainly the short-term solutions of the food pantries, the meal sites, the shelters that play a very important role in our emergency food system. There's also the emergency, the Federal Nutrition Safety Net, so the previously mentioned program Food Share in Wisconsin. There's a number of other programs such as WIC, which is the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program, school meals, summer meals, and a variety of other programs that kind of work together to help families make ends meet and in their food situation. Beyond that, looking at those bigger picture economic questions that are going to help people resolve their food situation permanently are much more important and really the true way that we can kind of resolve this problem for all people.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Rob on the line in Sussex. Rob, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What did you want to share?
I think the WIC program he's talking about there, where they just pick out the staple items and you can't get anything you want. I think more people will be on board for supporting that versus where you just get a credit card and you go in there and you buy steaks and soda and everything that most people have to budget for. And a lot of people get a little ticked off in line when they see somebody pull a food stamp card and $200 worth of steaks and...
Rob, thank you. So I think Rob is concerned about, you know, abuse of this, looking at what people can and can't buy. And this has come up again from time to time in the legislature, people looking at, you know, should we put limits on what someone might be able to buy with their assistance? What do you have to say to Rob?
Well, I think it's an important, it's a good question. And I think we all want each other to be good public stewards of money that we're receiving, just like food share dollars. When the research has looked at the diets of people on food share, they haven't seen dramatic differences from the diets of the average American. So we can kind of tell that if there's a question around nutrition and decision food choices that is occurring at the grocery store, that's a global nutrition education concern that we might need to be looking at more broadly. Beyond simply restricting what we can purchase, there's a number of programs that are being piloted around the state, including ones here locally in Madison and Dane County that actually incentivize healthy food choices. So there's a Double Dollars program at farmers markets in Dane County now that the city of Madison and other partners have come together to allow people who are spending money at the farmers market on their EBT, on their food share card, to actually get that money doubled to have an additional benefit that can be spent on fresh fruits and vegetables. So incentivizing those healthy food choices rather than punitively limiting the food, which can be cumbersome and stigmatizing for a number of reasons, is you know, a way that I would suggest we can all kind of resolve some of that.
Rob, thanks for the call. And we go next to Dwayne calling from Butternut. Dwayne, hi.
Well, hello there. I hope you can hear me. I'm kind of in a bad spot with my cell phone here.
So far, so good.
Okay, great. Now, listen, I just kind of wondering if anybody has thought about, you know, you got a lot of restaurants and a lot of, let's say like casinos and stuff when they put on their
I think I made out the word buffet there. I think I got where he was going with that. Dwayne, you did you drifted away on us there, but I think he was getting at the amount of waste that can be generated from restaurants and, you know, buffets and grocery stores. And there's a number of advocates out there who say a lot of this food is still edible and it should be eaten. What about that as a part of the solution?
I think the recovery of food waste is definitely an important and possibly underlooked part of the food system as a whole that that creates a lot of opportunities. We know that a lot of restaurants and other vendors are reluctant to donate their used food for concerns around liability. But there are ways around that, and there are Good Samaritan laws that are in place so that those people can reach out. And again, another project to highlight would be one here in Dane County called the Feed Kitchen, which has done great work in food recovery from big corporations and their cafeteria systems, bringing that food, repackaging it, and then getting it out to the emergency food sites, the pantries and meal sites. They can't necessarily accept food that's in giant trays and things that are being used in restaurants, but if it's been repackaged in a commercial kitchen, then it can be redistributed in the emergency food system. So it's a capacity issue partly. Do we have access to those commercial kitchens and spaces that we can do that repackaging? And do we have the volunteer support and the kind of manpower to handle all of that?
Well, thank you for the call, Dwayne. And our next caller is Amaya in Manitowoc. Amaya, hi.
Hi. I don't know what to say as in terms of a suggestion to fix it, because I'm not really sure, but I do have to say, especially speaking about the programs that the school has, we have two kids here, and they do take advantage of the school breakfast and lunch during the summer as well, which is a huge help. But when you go on Facebook, when you're online, social media, there are so many memes floating around that are just demonizing people who are struggling. And it seems like there's such a dehumanization of the poor in general. And I think it makes it a lot harder for people to be willing to seek out that help, because there's so much judgment that they face on a regular basis. And you don't know what somebody's going through, but it's so easy for people to make a quick judgment and treat you poorly as a result. And I think that's a shame, because then kids suffer as well.
Amaya, thank you for that. And she is getting at the problem that you've been talking about a little bit, Nick, as well. Stigma that can surround issues like this, issues of shame that can be barriers to people getting the food that they need. So how do you begin to combat something like that?
You know, I think we all can understand that these kind of crises can occur to anybody at any given time. When you lose a job, or you lose a spouse, or somebody who might be supporting your family. So having some understanding generally that this could happen to any of us is important. But to specifically address stigma, can we create an environment where when kids are participating in the program, they are comfortable with the way that the system is set up, so that they don't have to eat separately from the kids who might be having the hot lunch, or the free lunch, or excuse me, the kids who are giving a free meal aren't being seated or eating separately. That when you're spending money in the grocery store, it's not a significantly different experience than when you're swiping your normal credit card. Another population that's particularly vulnerable to that issue around stigma is seniors and older adults who have... Surveys have shown they have a lot of perceptions that are less willing to work with some of these available nutrition programs. And so making these programs, helping folks understand that these programs are available to everybody, and that they're really designed to help people get out of that short-term crisis, is very important.
Now, you mentioned earlier that pantries can contribute to the solution. They're often, it sounds like, seen sort of as the emergency solution when you don't have other avenues, other assistance available to you. Are the pantries in Wisconsin and in Dane County, are they able to handle the people who come to them? Do they have the capacity right now, or are we seeing pantries that are strapped?
Well, I know that the pantries always see an influx of donations around the winter holidays, and certainly something that we can all remember is that they continue to see clients throughout the rest of the year. So donating food at any time in the year, including the summer, when they do see an uptick, they actually see higher participation in the summer due to those children out of school, can be very important. So helping understand that our emergency food system kind of fills in those gaps in the access question can be very important.
Now, in our last 30 seconds here, if someone's listening and they are looking for resources and places to go for help, where would you direct them?
The first place you can always try is to call 211 locally. That's a directory assistance that can help you find food resources in your area. Other community resources, include UW Extension in your community, might have a list of resources available to you.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking there to Nick Heckman. He's the food security policy analyst at Public Health Madison in Dane County. And he joined us there to talk about food insecurity here in Wisconsin. And don't forget, you can still join this conversation. You can tell us your story and your thoughts, maybe your solutions, what you've gone through. You can let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Also keep current with what we've done, what we're doing today on Central Time, what we've done in the past. We always love to hear from you. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. This Monday, we got in the summer spirit by sharing book recommendations for your summer reading list.
And we heard from a lot of folks here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and we have some pretty serious readers, it turns out, on board. Here's what they're reading.
James in the WPR Finance Department recommends a book called Soccermatics. Pretty timely for right now, I guess. It's a book that uses mathematical modeling and game theory to explain soccer. And James says, as a soccer fan and a player and a math geek, it's the intersection of two of his personal interests.
Lisa, who is a WPR graphic designer and copy editor, said she just finished The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich. It was published 4 years ago and takes place on an Ojibwe reservation in North Dakota. It's kind of a coming-of-age story, and Lisa describes it as a wonderful, touching, and thoughtful story.
And Sarah Jacobs, WPR's membership director, recommended The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey by Gabriel Zevin. And this is a book about a bookstore owner whose business is a struggle, but is life is transformed when he receives a mysterious package.
So, Veronica, what's on your list for the summer? What kind of books do you like to read? Light things or?
In the summer, I do lighten it up and a little. In the winter, I'm willing to bog down with something that's a little thicker and denser. But in the winter, I like to keep it fun. So I'm reading some mysteries and fantasy right now. What about you?
I'm actually reading a book called Super Sushi Ramen Express, One Family's Journey Through the Belly of Japan. It's a lot of fun. It's about a family and really great travelogue.
Summer reading is here. Well, you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.